welcome to meeting. You are having an agenda for us. Hope we all have for this agenda. We are going to be very much economically for our time because of many other responsibilities. Having welcome you. Okay. DGs and officials, you are also welcome. Maybe let's start with our presentation before that, looking at our apologies. I received an apology from Honorable Quakis. We do form a quorum. We can now start with our the select committee's business. There will be two big presentations that will be led by our members. The first being led by the select committee's secretary, Aska. Can I now hand over to him to lead us so that we can continue with that presentation? Thank you.
Thank you, members, everyone present, thank you very much. I'll be presenting the legacy report of the previous committee, which is the title is the Report of the Select Committee on Land Environmental Affairs on its activities undertaken during the fourth parliament. I will essentially jump to page 19 because the first few pages will be covered by Deshni in her presentation with the key that highlights the challenges. I'm really going through the functions of the committee and mostly the statistical data of what the committee has done and has not done. On page 19, it's just the functions of the committee.
We all have documents, honorable members.
Committees are mandated to monitor the financial and non-financial performance of government departments and the entities to ensure that national objectives are met, process pass legislation, facilitate public participation in Parliament relating to issues of oversight and legislation. The key policy initiatives undertaken by the departments in the land and environment sector over a five-year period have occurred under the outcomes approach framework of the South African government. The 12 outcomes were launched in January 2010. The two relevant outcomes for the land and environmental sector included outcome 7, vibrant, equitable and sustainable rural communities with food security for all, and outcome 10, environmental assets and natural resources that are well protected and continually enhanced. It is within this context that the select committee identified key projects and programs to conduct its oversight over the departments within the cluster as proposed in the strategic plan of the committee. The methodology the method of work of the committee, the methodology used by the committee was to conduct the oversight all over the executive stem from the strategic planning session that was held in 2009. Following this session, the strategic plan that was devised set out the framework of activities for the five-year period. The activities proposed in the strategic planning were scheduled into an annual plan and program of the committee. The strategic plan was reviewed annually to reprioritize specific projects for oversight. For brief meetings, the committee management team prior every meeting to ensure that the content specific issues were clarified and specific issues were raised so that meetings with the executive were more strategic. 1.4 is the purpose of the report. Number 2 is the key statistics. What we did here, we had a table, activity and the period for 09, 010, 10 to 11, 11 to 12, etc. And it just gives you and clear understanding of how much meetings, oversight visits, etc. was undertaken during that period. Number 3 is the list of the stakeholders and the areas of interest. 4.4 will be covered by the HNI briefings and public hearings, the Agriculture Forest Division. All those issues will be covered by HNI in her presentation. To legislation. The following piece of legislation referred to the committee and process during the fourth parliament. 09, 10, there were none. 10, 11, we had these registries amendment bill and the sectional titles amendment bill. Both were section 75s. They were dealt with and adopted by the committee. We also had the Black Authorities Act, the repeal bill, which was also adopted. 11, 12, we only saw one piece of legislation, which was the Rural Development and Land Reform General Amendment Bill. 2012, 13, there was no legislation. 13 and 14 was geomatic professions, the National Environmental Management Laws First Amendment, Spatial Planning, Land Use Management Bill, National Environmental Management Law, Second Amendment Bill, Deeds Registries Amendment Bill, Sectional Titles Amendment Bill, South African Letter Services Amendment Bill, National Environmental Management Air Quality. That was in 2014 we had the Air Quality, the National Environmental Management Integrated Coastal Management Bill, Marine Living Resources Amendment Bill, Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, National Environmental Management Laws Third Amendment Bill, and also the National Environmental Management Waste Amendment Bill and the Water Amendment Bill. 2013, 2014, the previous committee, Land and Environmental, saw most of its legislation. I think during that period we processed a total of 16 or 17 pieces of legislation. All of them were adopted without any problems. The only bill that went for mediation was the Integrated Coastal Management Bill. Was the only one that went for mediation, and it was also resolved amicably by the mediation committee. Oversight trips undertaken during 09, 010, there was no oversight visits. During 10, 11, we had an oversight visit to the Eastern Cape, namely to the Lubisi Dam, also to the Kamata Irrigation Scheme, Kofimvava Waste Management Project, and the Noga Irrigation Scheme. That report was adopted. 2011-12, the area visited was the Hartbeespoort Dam and the Isake Mukhawaneng area in the Northwest Project. The delegation's overall assessment, the recommendations are there. In 2012-13, the committee undertook a trip to KZN Mzekulu, the local municipality, and also at the same time we went to the Eastern Cape to Port St. John's and Deni local municipality and the Nguma local municipality. All the recommendations are in the table. We also undertook an oversight visit to Moyeje. During that trip, we visited the primary school renovation project, Masina Women's Garden Cooperative, the Moyeje Water Treatment Facility, and the Nene Family House, and the Moyeje Hospital Community Center. There was a debriefing session held in Moyeje with stakeholders. 2013-14, committee did not undertake any oversight visit because of the influx of legislation. It was just, we were running 4 or 5 bills concurrently at any given time, so the committee did not have an opportunity to undertake any oversight visits during the 2013-2014 period. Study tours, the only study tours to undertaken, number 7 was 2011-12, the committee undertook a study tour to India. Challenges and issues of follow-up will also be covered in Dashni's presentation on the content. International agreements, 2010-2011, we had the agreement on the mutual acceptance of oenological practices by the World Wine Trade Group, as well as the agreements on the requirements for wine labeling of the World Wine Trade Group. 2011-12 was none. 13-14, we saw the Benguela Current Convention on Environmental Protection and Conservation of the Benguela Current Large Marine Ecosystem between the government of the Republic of Angola and Namibia and South Africa. Then it was the Annex 62 Protocol on Environmental Protection to the Antarctic Treaty. The challenges and issues of follow-up will also be raised during Dashni's content. And the statutory appointments, 9, 10, 11, and 12, was a nomination and consideration by the committee permissions to be made to the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries for candidates to serve on the National Land Council Marketing Council. This was adopted by the committee. Nominations to the board of the Land Bank, the Land and Agricultural Development Bank, was also dealt with. In 12-13 was none. 13-14 was also the nomination to the National Agricultural Marketing Council. There were no petitions. Obligations conferred in the committee by the legislation, challenging him, but not much. The rest of the, from page 76 to 90, is these outstanding issues will then be covered by Dashni in her content document. Thank you. It was just a brief rundown of the statistics of the committee, of the previous select committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable members, can we maybe allow the second presentation because they complement one another so that we can have an insight of the legacy, critical issues, that are finished top of our previous, without casting any aspersion, but let's have at least an insight of what is it that has been done. Can we, as you go along, keep on areas where we really feel that we're putting your questions on. Dashni, can you continue with your report?
Good morning, members. I just want to refer to the two documents that I'll be using. Basically, it's the document that's called the Sectorial Analysis and Strategic Priorities of the Committee. So it's this document, but what I've managed to do is that I've put it in a PowerPoint format. So it's basically this document, but just easier to see. Yeah. So I'll be presenting our clips, but it's mainly the narrative. This is the narrative. Okay, so basically the outline of my presentation. Of course, I'd like to give you some contextual background, then provide the legislative and policy context. Then I'd like to briefly go through... Then I'd like to give you just briefly the mandate of the different departments, and then look at the implications for oversight. The bulk of the omissions in ASCA's legacy report will actually be in that last bullet, the implications for oversight, where we look at what we did in the fourth parliament and then what we'd like to do in going forward in the fifth. So basically our committee is the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, and the core objective is to pass legislation, process international agreements, facilitate public participation, and then importantly to conduct oversight over government departments. Now, ASCA has gone through a whole list of legislation that the committee has done in the last term, and that's just to get you familiar with the type of legislation that this committee is busy with. He also mentioned a few of the international agreements, which is we don't actually ratify the agreements, we just consider and we make recommendations, and then we that will go through, we write a report and we let the House consider. Facilitating public participation, this specifically happens during the legislation process, and then also when the public writes to the committee to either listen to different cases or to hear if when they're having problems with accessing government departments. And then importantly, we have to conduct oversight, which is our core role, to look at how government departments that report to the committee, how they actually spend their budgets, their allocated budgets, and look at the progress that they're making with key government programs within the provinces. As of this year, we have a new mandate. Since water affairs was removed from our portfolio, and we got mineral resources instead. So there was a shift in our committee. We'll have a look at that when we're doing our strategic planning session. As Kalari presented on the legacy report, and you would have noticed the large number of water issues that we dealt with and the associated legislation. So all of that now falls away, and we have mineral resources to address, which is also a key priority of government. So that's just the departments that we now conduct oversight over. So we get a legislative mandate, of course, from the Constitution, specifically Chapter 4, and then Section 60 of the Constitution, which specifically looks at the National Council of Provinces. I've got my notes here. Who's needing it? Sorry about that. There's a printing problem, so we actually have very limited copies of documents. So, yeah. So, specifically, the mandate of the committee is from Chapter 4 of the Constitution, and then Section 60 that specifically deals with the National Council of Provinces. Then to supplement the mandate, we have specifically the rules of Parliament, the National Council of Provinces rules, and the joint rules. Now, I specifically put this point in because the committee secretary is the procedural officer for the committee. And you'll often see him interrupting the chair or sending notes to the chairperson to advise him of procedural issues that generally crop up during a meeting. ASCA generally has a copy of the rules, and the members would have gotten the rules during their induction. If they haven't, you can get them at stores. Then to assist us in the smooth operation of our committees, we have the standard operating procedures. This is an internal document, and that's mainly to look at how efficiently the committee works. It sets out the rules for committee meetings, committee management meetings, and this is mainly for transparency and consistency, so that all committees function at the same, you know, with the same kind of set rules. And then specifically for our committee, from the Constitution, we have to deal with, or we have to look at how Section 24, Section 25, and Section 27 of the Constitution is implemented within each of the departments. Now, Section 24 specifically looks at the environmental rights. Section 25 is the property rights. And then Section 27.1b looks at food security with agriculture. So Section 24 would relate to environmental affairs. Section 25, rural development and land reform. And then 27 would be agriculture. With regards to the government policy context, specifically directly relating to our committee is Item 7, creating vibrant, equitable and sustainable rural communities with food security for all. And here, this outcome is shared with rural development and with agriculture, forestry and fisheries. Then we have Outcome 10, specifically relating to the environmental mandate, ensuring that environmental assets and natural resources are well protected and continually enhanced. I have included Outcome 4 in my notes. I didn't put it in the document because it's something that I wanted to add on later on. It's Outcome 4 relates to creating decent jobs, and it's the employment outcome which most departments have to take into consideration, and that's all aligned with the NDP. So actually, if you look at, if you're looking at each of the our government departments that are that report to the committee, they specifically will look at creating jobs. So with regards to the policy context and the national development plan, specifically that relates to our committee is Chapter 5, which looks at the environmental sustainability and an equitable transition to a low-carbon economy. Now, what I've done is I've put together another document, which is an annexure, that I will send out to members later on, where I specifically take the Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 of the NDP, and then we look at all the indicators. That's one of the first documents that we'll use during our strategic planning session, because our committee will have to look at how government departments are actually looking at implementing what the NDP says. So chapters 5 and 6 of the NDP are specific to our committee, and that needs to be read, and I've got a summary document that I will circulate with regards to that. So chapter 6 looks at rural development specifically, and I've already mentioned we need to monitor the indicators. Some of the policy context, we have a State of the Nation address. What I've done in the narrative document you would have seen, I have highlighted key themes. So basically, I looked at the whole of the Sona's speech, and I picked out key things for our committee specifically. So the key themes, and I've expanded on it in the narrative, but the key themes in the Sona is to look at sustainable mining and this specifically the socioeconomic conditions within the sector. And that specifically relates to the president was very, very clear with regards to the revitalization of mining towns. And he mentioned, I think, about 6 or 7 of them, and you see that they're in various provinces. Those we would highlight, for example, when we do our strategic planning session for oversight. We'd like to go and see what the department is doing with regard to revitalizing the mining town. The president has stated it in the State of the Nation address. It's also aligned with other key government policy documents. So as a committee, we need to conduct our oversight and assess what's happening with regards to what has been set out. The second theme is sustainable development within the sector. And that specifically deals with Chapter 5 of the NEP, as well as looking at what environment, the Department of Environmental Affairs and Rural Development has set out within their strategic plans and annual performance plans. What I've also done in the narrative document is In brackets after each theme, I've highlighted which department is responsible. So that's just for members to get an idea of what the committee should do. So, for example, with sustainable development, I said, monitor the implementation of the Sustainable Development Workstream of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordination Committee. We all know that the committee exists, and we all know that there's the Strategic Infrastructure Project, all the SIPs. And the SIPs are very specific government projects that need to create jobs, and they need to have strategic impact in different areas. And what we as a committee, we need to look at, because our mandate is to ensure that the environmental rights of South Africans is actually taken into account. That's something that we need to look at when we do our oversight. The next theme is energy security with respect to shale gas exploration. Now, that's going to be, I think, well, not going to, it's, members would be aware that it's quite a contentious issue in the media at the moment. But as a country, and specifically within the committee, we have both departments reporting to us. So we have mineral resources and we have environmental affairs. So environmental affairs will specifically look at the environmental aspects of shale gas exploration. I mean, we all know that it can be quite toxic to the environment, and it's very... it needs a lot of water. But we also need to know that we are a developmental state and we need energy. We also have international obligations with regards to our carbon emissions. So we signed international agreements and we need to ensure that our carbon emissions decrease, but we also need to ensure that we have energy to secure our development. So that's the situation as a country that we're in, but more specifically as a committee, because we have both these departments that report to us. But it's something that we need to, and there I'd like to probably, when we're doing a strategic planning session, I'd probably like to suggest that we have actually a seminar. We get some experts in, and we have a robust discussion and debate around shale gas, so that we're all informed, and when there's debates in the House, we're all able to debate with from an informed position. So that's the kind of idea I have with regards to some of the key themes that are selected. Then moving on, we have the expanded public works programs, more specifically the green jobs. We had environmental affairs here last week, and I think it was Dr. Guy Preston that presented on all the environmental jobs. Our budget, the budget allocated for environmental programs, it's over 3 billion rands. That's the biggest budget allocation for environmental affairs. It's the bulk of their budget is allocated to environmental programs, which is all these working for programs. So there's working for water, working for wetlands, working on fire, all those working for programs where they specifically target women and the youth. And there's a whole lot of programs that happen within different provinces, where they look at together at like restoring ecosystem services, but also creating jobs and ensuring that the people get not only employment but get skills as well, because it's quite an intense skills training package that they get equipped with. So and that links up as well with outcome 4, where all government departments need to start looking at how they're creating these decent jobs. So the next theme I highlight is agricultural production and food security. Specifically here, you would have noticed in most of the budget speeches or the budget presentations of the department, here I'm referring to agriculture, forestry and fishing, where they specifically look at this food security program called FISA-TLALA. Now, FISA-TLALA is going to be implemented in all of the provinces. There's a lot of money allocated to it, and will be transferred to provinces for it to be implemented. That is something that we need to do strict oversight on. FISA-TLALA is actually not a new program. Previously, in the legacy report that AFCA presented, it had different names. It was Masaba Masani, and there were lots of other programs that this project was known as. And that also looked at food security, but it also looked at ensuring that smallholder farmers got agricultural resources and support. But what we found when we did our oversight during taking Parliament to the people and other oversight visits, we found that a lot of the money got transferred to the provinces, but not a lot of it went to the people. Or some of it went, so like you'd get tractors, but you wouldn't get implements. You wouldn't get fertilizers. There wouldn't be fuel. There wouldn't be a driver. So this is something that I highlight specifically for the committee to look at. It's well and good to have, and I mean the department and the minister has spoken a lot about Sikhlala and how it's really meant to bring, I think it's over 1 million hectares of beans and maize into production. But we need to ask, where exactly is the land? How relevant are those specific crops to looking at food security at a community level, at a household level? So this is the type of questions that the committee needs to really grapple with. And that's maybe something I also see, we can have some kind of awareness day. We get the department here, we get a couple of the provinces here, where they actually come and talk to us about the challenges that they're experiencing. Because I can tell you now, whatever we can raise, and we've raised it in our legacy report, the challenges, but the departments would blame the provinces, and then the provinces blame the department. So as a committee, we need to start looking at how we actually start grappling with the issue of food security, specifically because it's a constitutional right. Also, it's one of the, it's linked to one of the outcomes, and it's linked to key government priorities. So that's something that we need to highlight, and we need to look at how we're going to look at it holistically. Then the last two themes deal with rural development and land reform. The president has already reopened. We've passed the bill to reopen the new land game. And specifically here, I wanted to raise how the previous land claim process, there's still outstanding land claims from there. The department needs to be clear that those claimants are not going to be marginalized. We're still going to have money to ensure that, because most of them, the 5%, I think, is the percentage that the department says. Those 5% of claims are actually very complex claims in very lucrative area. A lot of them in KZN along the Sugar Belt, up in, I think it's in Mpumalanga and Nelspruit, that Nelspruit area where all the tropical fruit farming occurs. So we need to be, and up, I think, Kruger as well. So we need to be clear, the department needs to be clear with regards to how we're going to be dealing with those outstanding land claims. What's going to happen to the money that needs to be paid to these two claimants. Another issue that I'd like to raise here is, and we tried to bring it through when the amendment bill came through, is what happens to the people, to the claimants that have already been given restored the land rights. And then, for example, I'll use myself. So I was, my husband and I, we made the claim, and then subsequently the claim was awarded and we got the land, and then my husband died. So all that money that was spent in actually restoring the land to me, and now other people from the community can now access that land. There isn't any kind of ring fencing for those kind of issues. If government spends a whole lot of money in verifying the claim, processing the claim, buying the land, and restoring the land. But now it's not open for anybody else to claim it. And I'm specifically highlighting the plight of rural women and vulnerable, the vulnerable groups, so like child-headed households and then widows, for example. And then the last theme, sorry, I know I spoke a lot here, but that's the key thing now. The other thing is the last thing will be the land reform. Here I specifically highlight the recapitalization and development program. This is a program I'm not very comfortable with, because there's a lot of money allocated to it. And the reason why I'm not comfortable with it is because if you look at what has been happening, We've been taking the department's been taking a lot of money from restitution and from land reform, and specifically from restitution and land reform. I hope I'm not getting confused. And taking it into rural development. Now the recapitalization and development program specifically looks at failing land reform projects. So we've already spent a whole lot of money, as in government and the department, on restoring the land back to communities or buying farms and making sure that they now are functional. And then, after like 5 years or 3 years, they all start failing again. Now, the recapitalization and development fund is actually to start helping those. Now, there's various reasons for that. It could be that the strategic partner was took all the money and ran away. It could be that there was a lot of conflict within the community. But the point is that it specifically looks at failing projects. And then there is a feasibility. I mean, I'm not saying that the department just keeps on pumping money into failing projects. There is a strict feasibility process that it has to go through. But it's my concern is that we're putting in a whole lot of money from reprioritizing money from restitution into rehab and rural infrastructure. There's a new program called Rural Enterprise Infrastructure Program. So there's a big drive to move there. But I think we need to also start looking specifically at what kind of projects are we funding. I looked at information that the department sent to us yesterday. And some of the impacts that they're looking at is to create social cohesion. But they're not telling us what specific, how do you measure social cohesion? It's not very tangible. And I mean, building a multi-purpose center doesn't actually mean that the people, you know, that they're creating social cohesion. So that's some of the things I think we need to interrogate as a committee. We need to just interrogate specifically what rural development means when they say rural development. Because it's not, I don't think it's how it was conceptualized, rural development, when they presented the concept to us 5 years ago. I think they're straying a little bit away from what rural development actually means, and I think this is an area that we need to start as a committee looking strictly at. Okay, then the medium-term strategic framework and government program of action is still going to be coming, but we need to look, when we're in our strategic planning session, is to specifically look, we've already got the background within SONA, the NDP, the outcomes approach. We know what government needs to do and the priorities. And we as a committee need to just identify whether the activities are reflected in their strategic plans and the annual performance plans. Okay. Now I'm specifically moving to, it's hopefully going to go quicker, to the government department. My apologies, members. This presentation was actually meant to be given much earlier so that you could conceptualize the government department when they had the budget, when they presented the budget votes. But we were asked to just fast-track the budget votes, and that's why it's like a little bit out of sync. But I'm just going to go through each of the government departments. So the Department of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries specifically, okay, I'm not going to read everything you can read, but it's meant to develop specifically subsistence producers and within all of our policy documents, land farm beneficiaries and smallholder farmers. Those are the key target groups that we're looking at, and this is mainly to look at food security and then sustainable livelihoods. So the sector priorities for this department, and this is what I've gotten from the legacy report together with all the policy documents that are around, and these are the priorities we will discuss when we're doing a strategic planning session. We'll prioritize and we'll also link them with like agriculture and rural development or agriculture and mining. So we'll be able to specifically link them when we're doing our strategic planning session. So here within agriculture, forestry and fisheries, I highlight extension services and the agricultural support to smallholders and land farm beneficiaries. This is an area that in all of the reports, taking Parliament to the people, provincial week, oversight reports, this is something that you will see if there's a big gap and a big challenge here. What kind of services and agricultural support are provided to smallholders and land reform beneficiaries? Extension services specifically for this department have been a problem. There has been a consultant that was outsourced to have a look at how they can turn around to provide some kind of turnaround strategy with regards to extension services. And I don't know if Corvus covers this in his presentation, but there's a lot of statistics with regards to qualifications, with regards to numbers. Yes, okay. But I know there is work done on that with regards to what kind of service we're actually providing to smallholders and land farm beneficiaries. I've spoken already, second bullet point in length, about food security and the FISA-CLALA program. And then another priority that comes up very, very key, and it comes up all the time within when we're doing oversight, is the sustainability of agricultural cooperatives. If you look, there's cooperatives everywhere. That's one of the vehicles that rural development uses when they specifically setting up land reform projects and restitution. But there's also a very, very high percent, a high failure rate within agricultural cooperatives. I had a look at in Mpumalanga province, and I know as a province they have a strategy with regard to how they deal with cooperatives. And I'm thinking at a national level we need some kind of strategy specifically geared to address agricultural cooperatives. And maybe let's look at it at a national level, have a framework and then have specifically core problems. What is applicable within the provincial sphere? That's something that we need to think and we need to engage the departments on. The next point many members would already be very familiar with, the small-scale fisheries policy and more specifically the recent rights allocation process, which has been declared, I think, unconstitutional, or it wasn't done properly. So the minister has put a hold on the right allocation process. It's going to be redone, but our concern as a committee is that there's rights that are expiring in June and August, I think. Very lucrative rights, and we need to start looking at how the department is going to deal with those. I mean, people depend on this. It's all our coastal communities, and their livelihoods depend on these fisheries. So we need to start looking at how the small scale fisheries policy, and then how the rights allocation process is going to be taken forward. Another interesting priority, and why I like to highlight it, is because the minister has also announced, I think he's announced this in his budget speech in the National Assembly, is the Climate Smart Agriculture, it's an alliance, and it's going to be launched by the UN in the next couple of months. There was a conference last year in December in Johannesburg, and where they specifically, hosted by the department, together with its alliance partners. It was an international conference, and they came together with a declaration. I have a copy of that, and that's something that, as a source document, that I will send out to the committee. But very specifically says how we need to start doing agriculture, given taking climate change into account and looking at how we look at food security and economic potential, bearing in mind that we're going to be having limited resources to deal with. So that's, and the minister has mentioned it in the budget speech in the NA. Okay. I'm moving on to the next department, rural development and land reform. Basically, rural development has a mandate to create and maintain equitable and sustainable land expectation and to act as a coordinator and catalyst in rural development. And I think this is where we actually need to start looking at the department and specifically critically looking at the catalysts. What kind of catalytic function do they want to want to play within the rural economy. The main vision, of course, is Outcome 7, creating vibrant, equitable, and sustainable rural communities, which is all aligned with current government policy. The key sector priority for the department that I've looked at is, of course, the Comprehensive Rural Development Program. Now, this program was launched in 2009, August, by the President. And specifically, it was piloted in, I think, nine pilot projects within each of the nine provinces. And then slowly gained momentum, and they prioritized 23 routes are looking at the poorest ward within the country. So this is like a poverty alleviation kind of program, specifically looking at developing the rural economy. Other key areas for Altamati's oversight is this rural enterprise infrastructure program. And if you look at the budget of the department, there's a big chunk of money that goes within, that is allocated to rural development, and then the rural infrastructure program, recapitalization and development program. And then they have the strategic infrastructure projects, which are part of the SIP package. There's specific ones that rural development are the main coordinator of. Land reform, there's the green paper. That is something that we need to engage the department further on. They did present to us a few years ago the very draft version of the green paper. It has subsequently been beefed up. It's a longer version, but we need to start engaging them and having more discussions around that. And this is where we can start influencing where land reform is going within the country. Restitution, specifically we're highlighting the land claims, and this is the previous one, and then we need to start looking at how they're going to be dealing with the new land claim process. Interestingly enough, the new system you'll only be able to lodge electronically. So they have nine or 20, I can't remember. They have these centers all over. And you'll need to go and lodge your land claim at these centres. I think there is one in Mowbray at the cadastral data, at the mill there. The other priority is farm evictions, and then security of tenure for labour tenants. What we found is in our previous oversights and the taking Parliament to the people programs, there's a lot of farm evictions that happen, and it can be seasonal. There's different causes for these kinds of evictions, but that's something that we need to engage the department with on what kind of strategy they have to deal with them. Farm workers have already been highlighted as a very vulnerable group, and we saw recently, or 2 years ago, from the various farm worker strikes that we really need to start looking at. We need to start looking at how we deal with that specific sector of our society. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the mandate of environmental affairs. It's basically in the presentation and the narrative, but it deals with Section 24 of the Constitution. The key priorities is to look at, okay, I've highlighted here, also all in line with government policy, looking at the accelerated infrastructure program and the national infrastructure plan and how it affects biodiversity and conservation. Remember, we've also, South Africa is signatory to the Convention on Biodiversity, and there's certain international obligations that we have we're signatory to, and we need to start looking at how our infrastructure program impacts biodiversity and conservation, especially if you're looking at the ecosystem services that we lose when we just have buildings everywhere. Something that has been in the media is the impact of acid mine drainage to the economy of the country. This specifically, we did highlight it in our last, in our previous term to actually go and look at it in Gauteng and in Mpumalanga, and it's still on the card, so it's something that we need to be. The department has come in and provided a presentation, but we're in a better position this year because we have both mineral resources that causes the acid mine drainage, and then we have environmental affairs that has to deal with it. So, I mean, it's something that we can look at when we're doing our strategic planning session. On all these areas where the departments overlap, that's where we can look at getting the departments to discuss. Then we have the green economy development. This, I put this bullet point up because I wanted members to make reference to the Green Fund presentation. That's why we asked them to the Department of Environmental Affairs to present on the Green Fund, because we specifically wanted to know there's a lot of money allocated to the Green Fund. How much of it is actually going to the provinces? So there's about 40 projects that have been selected, and I think 20 are divided amongst the different provinces. Then we have the National Strategy for Sustainable Development. Environmental Affairs, I have to say, they have fantastic legislation and wonderful policies, but there's a lot of other departments that need to implement their policies. They battle with showing any kind of progress with regards to implementation. The Strategy for Sustainable Development, I know there was a conference on it a few years ago, but there hasn't been much on it. Linked to the strategy are the State of the Environment reports, and I have to say the one for 2014 was outsourced, and it was meant to be released, but it hasn't been released yet. And that's because a lot of the sector departments there, sister sector departments, are not happy with how the state of the environment is, because their departments are contributing to it. So it's something you need to engage the department on. I've already mentioned the Convention on Biodiversity. CITES, members will be alerted to the whole rhino issue. That's a CITES species, and then all the rhino poaching that goes with other CITES species, like cycads, for example. They're also CITES listed, and that's something that's also an international agreement that we signatory to, and we need to get updates from the department with regards to how they're managing the processes. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's the UNCCC, that's also all the climate change work. We have the strategy on climate change. There's several policy documents there, and related to that are all our carbon reduction emission strategies. So that's also an area that I've highlighted within their budget for them to come and give us information on, because it's a key government priority. Coastal management, I specifically want to raise the issue of Dr. Mike Kisu in the budget presentation alluded to the lab program or lab project, which is specifically related to Operation Pakisa, which was launched by the President this weekend. Specifically looking at, it was launched in KZN, and it specifically looks at developing the ocean economy. They're projecting, I think, about 12,000 odd jobs to come out from the ocean's economy, and that's something that we need as a committee need to look at, because it relates to outcome 12 but and outcome 10, but specifically how we look at using natural resources to benefit all communities. Okay, mineral resources, their mandate is to promote and regulate minerals and mining sector. And then the key priorities here, and this specifically deals with the SONA. The President was very vocal about monitoring progress in implementing the Framework Agreement for Sustainable Mining that was signed by Business, Labor, and the Department in 2012. And that specifically looks at revitalizing and looking at accommodation for mine workers. That's a key area, priority for the country. And that's something that we need, because the Mineral Resources Report starts, we need to make sure. When they came to present on their budget vote, they didn't mention too much on the framework agreement. They have mentioned the environmental authorization and the one management system. That will relate to the new legislation that we passed where all the authorization for mining are combined integrated system. So you get a mining license, water license, environmental authorization all in one. So that's, we've kind of, government has put together legislation to fast track or to streamline the process. So that's in order. But now we need to hold the department and the mining sector accountable for how they're going to be looking at their other commitments with regards to mine workers. As you know, that's also a vulnerable group like farm workers, and it's a grouping that we need to look at. Social labor plans, that comes from the mining legislation. The department, when they presented their budget vote, spoke at length at aligning them with IDPs, the integrated development plans of local authorities and district authorities. I mean, that's well and good, but it could just be in their budgets and their strategic plans that they need to align. We need to actually engage them on what kind of appropriate projects and programs are they implementing to address the social labor issues within mining communities specifically. If you go out on oversight, it's something that comes up all the time. You have a mining community, and they get promised either school or water or a whole lot of like jobs and a whole lot of other economic development projects, and then nothing actually gets done. And then there's too few mine inspectors to go and look at implementation of the social labor plan. So that's something as a committee we need to look at how we're going to engage with. Acid mine draining, I've already spoken. Mining and biodiversity, these are areas where environmental affairs and mining, mineral resources, they come together. And as a committee, because both departments support us, we need to look at how we're going to be addressing those overlapping issues. I've already spoken a lot with regards to the oversight in the last term, and that is why I put these slides last, because what we did is when we designed oversight trips in the last term, we specifically looked at looking at key government programs and how they were implemented within different areas. So if we went to a municipality, we looked at the CRDP. We looked at the food security program. So those are some of the things that we did look at. Ecological infrastructure and the ecosystem services, that we put in our strategic plan, and that was specifically we were going to look at wetlands in and coal mining in Mpumalanga. We didn't manage to do that, but that's something that we need to look at for the new in the new term. Then what I removed, or I'm highlighting here, but actually we don't have to look at in the new term, is all the water affairs, all the bulk infrastructure program, and the water quality, blue drop, green drop, etc. Those were key things that we looked at when we went to municipalities. Then the implications for oversight. I've spoken a lot at length, so this is something that we will discuss when we get our strategic plan session. But, I mean, the Agricultural Research Council is one of our the statutory bodies that reports to us. Why can't they assist the department in providing the extension services? We need to get the ARC and the department together and make sure that they have some kind of service level agreement, and then there's the extra funding, spending proposal that goes to the ARC, because they're also all around the country and they need to start extension services in an area that we need to actually increase access to land farm beneficiaries and smallholders. So we need to start thinking about innovative ways of how we move forward. So CRVP, here I mentioned how we need to look at some kind of evaluation program, and then also look at an evaluation of all of the different land reform policies. Are they actually working? And I think we need to either commission work here, or we need to get the department to commission, but it's something that we need to think about, and we can talk about it when we do strategic planning. I think this is the last slide. The impact of, I mean, I've discussed all of these issues, so the only issue I wanted to I raise here, and this comes from the legacy report, is the impact of the proposed hydrological power plant on the Orange River. And that's something that interested in it, and affected parties have written to us about, and there's a whole lot of documents with regards to that. So we have this International Commission on Management of the Orange Thank You River, which is, it's an international agreement, but also in the process of, I think there's like a proposal to have 7 hydrological power plants on the Orange River. And we need to start looking at ecological reserve and other issues with regards to that. Then, of course, the legislative conflicts with mining and in the environment. I previously had Water Victor, but now water is no longer with us. But it's something that we need to have a discussion, a robust discussion about all these overlapping areas. Oh, there's still more. Of course, very important for the committee to implement and look at how the department is looking at the food security zero hunger program. This specifically was mentioned in the SONA and other policy documents. That's something that we need to, as a committee, to look at. And then something that came up last year, the special rapporteur on the right to food, which directly relates to the food security issues. The special rapporteur has visited the country, I think, 2 years ago, and he did a report on the state of the food security in the country. And there were very specific recommendations that were made to, he met with several ministers, and there were specific recommendations that were made. I think agriculture is the coordinating ministry, and we had just one report from them on this, but we need to start tracking them. And then lastly, developing a monitoring and evaluation framework to monitor quarterly progress, all of the things that I've mentioned above. How we can actually start implementing it is to develop, and we'll do this during our strategic planning session, to how anything that we want in the department to do, how they're doing it, and we need to get progress reports on the achievements. Okay, so that is that. Sorry that was long, but we can have questions if there's time.
Thank you for the presentation. Thank you, honorable members. I know it's a lot of information that was very much important for us to have an insight of the legacy. But it would also be highly appreciated from all the departments. We need a success story, a specific project that we can really be proud that is addressing critical issues that has been raised, issues haunting the community outside there, projects that are successful addressing the issue in agriculture, the rural development, the mining sector. But the honorable member, can we just break for 5 minutes, get tea, and come back immediately after that 10 minutes?
Thank you.
Honorable members, can we allow the third presenter to continue the presentations? Robert, can you just lead us with your presentation? Thank you.
Thank you. Just before I start the presentation, some background on why perhaps you have a content advisor and a researcher presenting on very much the same topic. It might be confusing to individuals that are unfamiliar with Parliament structures. At present, the research unit sits completely independent from the committee section. We provide research support for all of Parliament outside of committee functioning as well, and as such report to different management and produce different documents. In terms of a committee, we will integrate the documents into a single package for a committee meeting, but we sit on a wealth of information that is not produced for any one specific committee, and therefore we might have information that is not part of committee documentation. Any question that any member of Parliament has can be forwarded to the committee section for further detail or for a new group to be produced should that be required. What I wanted to do, we don't have a printing facility in the research unit. We forwarded a written document. I did not forward the presentation because the presentation is merely pulling concepts out of the document that I would like to highlight. I am more than happy to forward the presentation to the committee when I am done with it, but it was produced right up until about midnight last night. I have to apologize for that, but as I said, my workload has me working outside of committee functions as well, and sometimes things just misfire in terms of timing. From a research perspective, what is really fascinating about where we sit in a select committee is government departments typically operate in silos. Our oversight and our public engagement shows us where these silos collide or overlap or clash with each other in terms of stated purpose. For instance, if we deal with fisheries, fisheries will tell us that the development of a small-scale fishery sector is a very, very important, urgent need. Environmental Affairs will tell us that they have just signed a Benguela Current Marine Ecosystem Conservation Protocol, which forbids the overutilization of the same resource. This puts the two departments into direct contestation, and as a committee, we will only hear one of the two sides. Hardly ever will we hear both sides at the same time. So when I try to do my research on the topic, I try to bring in the perspectives from other aspects of legislation or public experience that might differ from the single set of documents that we get from an individual department. We used to have water affairs in the committee. If we still had it, it would have been fantastic because that would have given us the entire five overlapping competencies in terms of resource utilization in the country. I can feed water-related matters into the committee, but we cannot have hearings on those topics. So I'm more than able to bring you any updates on water issues should the committee require such input. What I am trying to do in this presentation is to take department by department what we've got and to highlight what research has shown over the previous 5 years of committee activity and departmental interactions. I try to bundle these into key points that has either featured as issues of concern in the past or are likely to feature in the future. I know we are quite limited for time, and being last, everybody's going to be looking at me as the time runs out. So if I run through the slides fast and the members would like me to slow down, I'm more than willing to do that, but I do not think you want me to be slow. So I would rather be told to slow down and to speed up later. So my apologies if I skip through something that you find that you want more information on, but please slow me down should I be going too fast. In terms of transformation, a brief overview of what has happened is that government has taken over mineral rights, but basically decided to maintain the status quo with who are exploiting minerals with said agreements of transformation in the sector and benefits in terms of socio-economic development of communities. What is showing us today, or what is showing up, is in terms of the MPRDA and the social and labor plan development which these mines have agreed to and companies have agreed to, these are lagging behind in terms of implementation and in terms of outcomes that have been expected by the community and by government at this point in time. In theory, there should be a change in how communities and individuals responsible for mining and who are surrounded by mining areas benefit from mining. In terms of transformation, we are not seeing what we thought we would be seeing after the mining charter. And I think this is a theme that runs throughout my presentation. On paper, we have one theory. In practice, we are experiencing something different at times. And it's our job to dredge up differences because departments love bringing us the paper theory. They love bringing us broad statistics of money spent. They very seldom bring us impact assessments of what they are doing. And that's our job. The Department of Mineral Resources has also been reprimanded by the Auditor General regarding the issue around social labor plans. There is shortfalls in terms of companies reporting to the DMR regarding these plans, and these have been highlighted by the Auditor General. So it is not simply a case of industry dragging its feet, it's also a matter of oversight over these industries that has been highlighted in the past. In theory, the DMR is in a position to revoke mining rights in the country, but to date that has not happened, indicating a willingness to accept slow reporting and slow transformation, which I think is something worth looking into. The point highlighted by the department when they presented their budget and their performance plans and strategic plans is that as a country we are very good at producing raw materials. We are also very good at exporting those raw materials. Agriculture, I will highlight the same problem. If we manage to do value addition and downstream beneficiation, we will not only improve our GDP for each sector, but we will improve employment statistics and revenue generation within the country. You might see statistics being cited by people that mining and agriculture GDP is dropping in South Africa. It's convenient statistics. What is happening is the services sector has outperformed the natural resources sector in the country. They are not shrinking, they are performing badly, and beneficiation is one of the places where they can improve their contribution to the economy without essentially having to do more what they are in terms of exploitation, but in terms of beneficiation. The silo link there, however, is rural development. We have seen the country struggle with the difficulties of rural development. Roads, infrastructure, harbors, rail, all of these are required. It's easy to say that we should be doing something. Without the infrastructure, it is difficult to be doing these things. So the link between beneficiation and rural development is a very strong one, and it's something where the DTI, together with DMR, together with rural development, needs to focus together. Illegal mining is a growing concern. Few people realize that when a mine is shut down, it's not shut down because there's nothing left. It is because the company deems it financially too dangerous or too difficult to make a profit from mining. There is the resources down. And we are suffering losses in the billions because companies are not mining resources, but somebody else is, and we are not benefiting in terms of employment or tax revenue or beneficiation. In 2011, the loss was 6 billion rand of raw materials, so it's not an insignificant loss. Obviously, DMR is not a law enforcement body, so this problem goes beyond the management of mines and mining dumps. We're going to hear a lot about fracking and natural oil in the coming 5 years. I think if it's going to be probably the second most talked about issue after land reform, if I may raise some money. We are coal dependent, and coal dependence is not always an environmentally sound way of doing business, but we cannot simplify things by saying natural gas and oil will be better, but we will definitely be exploring those options. We will see direct concerned clashes with environmental affairs or with people with an environmental outlook on fracking and oil and gas. When we talk about Northern Natal, where we're starting to see potential exploration for oil, that Agalas current runs at about a meter per second. So if we have a BP spill like they had in the Gulf of Mexico, in theory, in Northern Natal, we will see that oil in Cape Town in less than a month. That is the reality of our coastline. And we will hear these concerns coming from environmental conservation type inputs, I'm sure. Fracking, the same concerns will come from individuals concerned about the water quality of the Karoo before and after hydrologic fluctuation, because it is an industry that is taking some heat internationally about their environmental record. And I do think the committee will hear a great deal of arguments in both directions in the coming years. There's no easy answer. It is not environmentally sustainable to be dependent on coal. It will not be without environmental consequences to exploit oil and gas. There's no clear winner. in this debate. We are, however, pro-oil and gas exploration, and we are pro-determining what resources we have. What is concerning to the industry, which I don't agree with them because it's not their resource to begin with, they will make a lot of noise about the government decision to amend the Minerals and Petroleum section of the legislation to force socio-economic benefits for the country and a shareholding of the country in the resource. I personally think it's high time we do have those discussions with mining companies, because if we look at the Norwegian model for oil extraction, they have built an enormous social safety net on the oil resources, and I think that's a model well worth looking at. These five emerging issues were highlighted by the Portfolio Committee. We have a draft Mine Health and Safety Amendment Bill coming, likely going to be in front of the committee for a resubmission. It did not make the fourth parliamentary cycle before the lapsing of that parliament. We are waiting for the Commission's finding on the Marikana situation. That has been delayed, but we are anticipating that report somewhere in the next term, hopefully. As mentioned, we are awaiting technical regulation for exploration and production of shale gas, and we are expecting the State Mining Company and the Petroleum Exploration and Exploitation Limited holdings, basically stakeholder entities, to be brought under DMR control. So those are basically five issues that are very likely to be coming our way. If I can quickly jump to DAF, Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, there are five main themes for me. There's, if I can start at the conflicting aims and objectives, we have details coming from there, so I'll just highlight them. Our expenditure on food security, our commercial sector trends, our small-scale sector trends, and overlapping competencies with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. These are not the only issues, but these are the issues that have been requested to be researched in the committee or in the parliamentary research unit in the past. My concern in terms of research work done on food security expenditure is we have no means of measuring what we are doing. And as a government and as an oversight function, that is a scary thing to sit here and say. We have no standardized measure of determining food security impacts of any of our projects and programs in the country. We have Stats SA monitoring households on a regular basis, but there's no ways of disentangling the 11 million child grants, the social supports, the expanded public works programs from our expenditure on food security programs. Therefore, if Stats SA tells us people are less hungry, we would like to ask Stats SA, who can we thank for that? And they cannot tell us. We have a basket of expenditure. We haven't got a detailed evaluation of each basket. We also do not know what has happened to past projects and past expenditure in terms of current state of production or impact in the community. Unfortunately, I heard the chair, I won't say it is unfortunate, my response to the chair will be unfortunate. When we are taken to take Parliament to the people at it or to oversight, it's not that we don't want to find good news stories, it is that we struggle to find good news stories. Project life cycles are very limited, and the projects that do appear to be looking as if they have got a good chance are typically projects that have had input from a DTI source, or an NGO, or somebody else that is taking some key long-term approach to projects. I have got some doubts about the department's long-term commitment to projects started in the past. Also, if we listen to the department's presentations, they very often talk about commercial focus. They would like to push recipients of their support down the line of commercialization or commercial-style production. And the question we then want to ask them is, are you trying to make people food secure through earnings or food secure through products? Because they do not claim any direction in their policies. They do not state whether we are trying to yield a certain amount of products. They do not try to claim that they want to create a certain amount of self-sufficient farmers. The food expenditure is labeled food security, and it's for us as oversight to try and figure out which of the two directions they are trying to follow. And this is what I want to highlight in the conflicting aims and objectives. It's difficult to take a smallholder farmer and make him food secure by telling him he has to be a commercial farmer. Because a commercial farmer needs to get a contract with a buyer, he needs to supply on a constant rate, he needs to supply on a constant quality. If we do not have fertilizer available every year, or plowing at the right season, that man or woman or co-op loses their contract, and investment of a certain volume this year turns into a stagnant project the next year. The department will admit that they struggle with extension. They will admit that they struggle with the mechanization support. Therefore, the question is, should we be forcing people into a high-risk farming venture when we cannot support them adequately all the time? That's, for me, an open question. Reports from the department hardly ever give us hectares planted, yields obtained, and the sustainability of past projects. They will tell us what they've done this year, and they will not refer back to past years. Questioning down those lines are also normally quite difficult. This is a rather busy slide, but I tried to trace food security projects from 2013 to now. Basically, what this mess indicates is that we have seen numerous new programs, the death of old programs and the renaming of old programs, the reshuffling of sub-programs into new reporting programs. What this means is that we struggle to trace expenditure, we struggle to follow projects and programs because they simply stop reporting about the same type of project. They will tell you that sub-program no longer exists, or we are now funding this type of project. From 2003 to 2010, we have spent money on farms. We last saw a huge focus shift in from 2011 to present. We are roughly running on a stable philosophy. But before that, we had multiple ministers and multiple philosophies. And as we can see by how the finances have flowed, multiple dead ends potentially on projects as well. I have highlighted in red some of the projects that are constantly reported on, which for the most time, the ILMA, LETSEMA, land care, food security, CASP, and extension recovery plan. I'm positive we will hear from again from the department. But when they come back, they report an umbrella. They will now call things Fetsaplala. It used to be something else. But Fetsaplala, you will not find in the estimates of national expenditure. You will not find it in program funding. You have to ask the department what of each program is in Fetsaplala. And then you have to ask rural development land reform if the million hectares under cultivation they are reporting on is the same million hectares that agriculture is reporting on, because they will individually tell us both that they are putting a million hectares under cultivation. The finances remain a bit difficult. Overarching, briefly, the commercial sector has lost commercial operators, it has shed jobs, it has shed access or portion of GDP, and it is not incorporating emerging farmers into a very, very, very competitive structure. I can say from personal experience, before I came to Parliament, we were working on agriculture development projects. The international market doesn't care about transformation. They don't care about aspects such as fair play or development or transformation. Product, volume, dependability. We are trying to transform an industry to a market that is not interested in what we are trying to do to the industry. They are demanding an end product only. And we are struggling to allow our developing commercial sector into that market. In this year's owner, the president declared that they would like to create just over 1 million jobs in agriculture by, I think he put it at 2030. to put that into context, we have lost more than that since 1994 with the restructuring of the commercial agriculture sector. So with all due respect to the president's goals, he wants to return the country to where it was in the past 30 and 20 years from now. We have to work harder than that. That's an admirable goal, but I think we can try to push harder than that and interrogate the sector as to how we are going to get back those jobs. Rural development is part of that scenario. On the flip side, the small-scale farmers complain about land access, they complain about funding access, they complain about market access, they complain about the extension services they are receiving, and they are complaining about what extension they receive when they do receive it. We have a definite pro-commercial focus, as said before, which discriminates against the production methods of subsistence small-scale farmers who are not trying to produce for a market, who are trying to produce for a local, for an informal market, or for home use. Those methods are being pushed aside in extension at the moment. This is a contentious one. Both rural development and land reform and agriculture work on extension. To work on project development. I would very much like to see one department responsible and ultimately developing policies around agricultural production and agricultural support. It is difficult to trace the liability when a project fails and you're on other side and there's an agriculture official and a rural development official and they are blaming each other. It's impossible to untangle the situation there. It's difficult to trace the money when it's an agriculture national competency, but the funds are transferred to the provincial rural development department for use in rural development, and that does happen. The money changes hands between agriculture and rural development. You have an agriculture official responsible until a certain point, and then a rural development official becomes responsible, and that creates tracking and monitoring problems for oversight. Very briefly, our fisheries scenario will be on our doorstep very soon. We have a long history of ignoring certain world players and certain communities in fisheries license allocation. When I say ignoring, I'm not meaning it badly. We have a transformation agenda in government. But the small-scale fishery sector, that has a very different perception of what they've experienced and what they were hoping for in terms of transformation. We have the matter of the current stock status to deal with, and we have unexpected climate change impacts to deal with. To sum it up in one sentence, we have to transform a sector that is oversubscribed and out of resources without losing any of the established sector, but creating opportunities for a sector that's been excluded. To me, that sounds impossible. And hence, we have the issues we've got. If we try to increase SOC allocations to a group, environmental affairs will have to be consulted about sustainability. If we try to take some of the established sectors, quotas, and hand it to the emerging sector, that sector will inform you that they cannot remain viable if they lose any more of their quota. The amount of quota given to a subsistence individual will not uplift him to become a commercial operator. That is the catch-22 in which we are operating at the moment. 5 to 8 year cycle since 94, we've been allocating fisheries rights in South Africa. We have not transformed the small-scale sector and brought them into the commercial sector. That is our legacy. It's not past government legacy. This is our legacy that we have to work through. It took High Court action against the department for them to consider the small-scale fisheries dilemma on a deadline from the courts. It is not something that I think they would want to dwell on for very long, but that's unfortunately where we are. The small-scale fishery sector is reliant on resources that simply isn't there anymore. Our rock lobster, our abalone, our lionfish, our beach seine stocks have collapsed or are collapsing. And how do you bring a person who has for 20 years been waiting for an opportunity to fish into an industry where there's nothing left to fish? It is a heartbreaking situation, but it's one that we will be addressing, I'm sure, in the committee over the next couple of months or years. The stock status is limited or non-existent. We cannot get around it. We have to acknowledge the challenges that we are in. West Coast rock lobster, I think, is hovering at around 3% of pristine. Abalone's collapsed. Lionfish has been in emergency management for a decade. We cannot get around these challenges. To add to our problems, researchers have found that fish populations and resource populations are shifting. Now, traditionally, the coast was divided up into zones, and a person was given access to a resource in a zone. The theory is very real that a zone might be completely devoid of a resource in the near future. West Coast rock lobster is moving. So it is no longer a case of giving a person a block and giving a person access to a resource in that block. The resource has moved out of that block. And that is a big challenge for how we deal with fisheries. I have to jump to rural development. I will stop if you want me to stop. I understand.
No, I'm just saying that you can't make one small place for this.
That is the logical approach that we are struggling with. If I might throw in a personal opinion, which you shouldn't be doing, I find it difficult to comprehend why we struggle in this country to make way for anybody else. And I will leave it there. I will not...
Honourable Member, can we just allow me to wrap up so that we can now start engaging?
In terms of rural development, we have seen on oversight post-settlement concerns, big issue. We have, I've got questions around CRDP, RADP, post-settlement support, and the claim settlement process. I will run through them as fast as I can. If I speed up on something, it's not because I think it's less important. It's because I'm trying to get through it. We had a meeting with stakeholders, a workshop last year, where a lot of concerns were highlighted that we were not that aware of after dealing with the department. We also have oversight visits, although I wish we had far more of them. On a number of occasions, we find strife within a beneficiary group. The way restitution is happening is volumes of land is given to large amounts of people and they are asked to work together to share the resource. Human nature being what it is, conflicts arise within benefit sharing agreements like that, and there is serious evidence, or at least allegations at times. We just started dealing with a case in the past where restituted land somehow, in a very convoluted way, ended up in a commercial land transaction because that land was used as surety on a commercial loan due to the influence of a mentor. Now, we cannot have that. If the state spends money on land, that land can never end up in a liquidation sale or offered as surety to a commercial loan or these kind of things. We are seeing that, not massively, but we are seeing that starting to happen. We are concerned about CRDP sustainability. I think the content advisor had raised this, so I won't dwell on it. Our experience, as limited as it is what we see on the ground does not look like the brochure, if I may be a little bit corny. We have visited Moeshe Village. Moeshe Village continues in rural development publications to have 300 food gardens. We found one, and it was a school garden. Moeshe Village's water is slightly toxic. So when they planned their food gardens, nobody stopped them and said, let's just make sure that the whole plan works here. And they discovered that the metal contents of the water is such that it cannot be used for irrigation. It appears as if the CRDP is a template that's being put down on different sites and not modify. And a very expensive system of, reverse osmosis was needed. Their own RO unit was required just to get them to drink the water that was made available to them. Now, you can't irrigate with reverse osmosis water. It's too expensive. So gradually, the food gardens came to a standstill. We do not know how prevalent this is across the country. Vishnu has alluded to our concerns about RODP. It is not, if I can just quickly jump out here, it is not for us a small matter when 105 million rands worth of farmland requires RODP within a couple of years. This farm also employed 500 people. It is no longer employing 500 people. So we have a snowball effect where a restituted piece of land does not get the support it needs. We've spent the money. We've lost the employment. We've lost the output. We have to spend more money to try to get back to that point. I do not want to hammer the department on this, but I can find numerous examples, and each one is worth around 100 million. And we tally up all that money. It is a serious amount of expenditure that we have to do to get back to the status quo. And if we return to the status quo, if we go back to our agriculture output and our employment situation, RADP and restitution has to be factored in there. Restitution is needed. Land reform is needed. So is output. So is employment. So is beneficiation of product. We cannot sacrifice employment opportunities and income generation opportunities because our projects need to be salvaged on a regular basis. We also heard in the workshop that we held that the community at large might not be aware of the departmental focus in their plans, or they might not subscribe exactly to what it is that the department wants. If this was an academic study done, if claimants are asked what they would want in terms of land, in terms of what they want to do with the land afterwards, it did not match what the department wants them to do with the land afterwards. Communities don't necessarily want to be in CPAs. They don't necessarily want to be in co-ops. They don't necessarily want to be commercial farmers. When this is the plan that comes at you after you've had a claim, it's difficult to break out of that and say, I want 4 hectares, I want a farm for my family, which is one of the things that seem to be a recurring theme when we have workshops, is I didn't ask to be a co-shareholder with 40 other people with 200 hectares. Why can't you give me that 4 hectares, give me a title deed and let me be? These conflicts are regularly occurring. In terms of post-settlement support, I think I can leave it there. The post-settlement support, I think, is where the department can speed up the rate at which they get a restituted piece of land to function again. But on that topic, though, from what I have gathered from the industry, I'm not a food farming expert, but the distance in time between a claim being lodged and a claim being settled, if it exceeds a decade, and that farmer doesn't reinvest in the farm, doesn't plant new banana orchards, doesn't maintain the farm out of fear of losing his recent investment after the farm was valued, somebody is getting a restituted piece of land that's on the verge of collapse. And we cannot have that continuing. If somebody puts a claim on a farm that needs to be maintained, and it takes 15 years to settle the claim, we have a problem. If we're going to settle a claim, we have to set it in such a way that what is there when the man or woman or group receives the farm. Environmental affairs, my apologies if they appear to be neglected, but I just really wanted to touch on two topics that is burning issues at the moment, and that is our species loss and our conservation and development priorities. Rhino poaching is a serious issue. We are also losing elephants at an alarming rate in southern Africa, not just South Africa, but 51% of Southern Africa's elephant mortalities at the moment is not natural. It's not long before they run out of easy elephants, and we will have easy elephants as we are having easy rhinos at the moment. I don't want to be trite about the situation, but we have lost, since we had a parliamentary workshop in 2012, and Sandparks and the rhino working group at that point in time told us that it looks like the situation is quite serious, but it looks like it's under control. We have lost nearly 2,000 rhinos since that statement without any drop in the rate of loss. We are now losing annually as many rhinos as we lost in the decade preceding that conference. It is not sustainable. The unfortunate reality is a dead rhino is worth twice as much as a live rhino. And that is the honest truth now. A rhino horn delivered to Vietnam is worth twice as much as anybody in South Africa is willing to pay for a live rhino on an auction. Who will stop this situation? It is an international problem. When you ask Sandparks who they think the poacher are, it is normally a low-level poacher that can get across the border between us and Mozambique, or us and Zimbabwe, or us and Swaziland. When you ask the international conservation bodies who the trafficker is, two names come up, and those two names are names that we don't really want to have to hear in our poacher problem. Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab. It is not a small problem, and it's not theory. Those, especially Al-Shabaab, has been infiltrated by investigators that can make direct links between elephant poaching in Southern Africa and Al-Shabaab's funding. We are not going to solve this problem without realizing that it is an international organized crime and terrorism linked problem. It's not a local law enforcement problem. We have the same problem with abalone. Abalone is very closely linked to the drug industry in the Western Cape and internationally. We have plant losses, 125 succulent species and 22 cycad species threatened by illegal collection. So rhino is the flagship species of a greater problem. We have porous borders and valuable plant and animal species. Unfortunately, the last slide is the one that is the most fascinating to me. I think it's the last slide. Let's hope I don't embarrass myself and find more. We have a South African environmental conservation track record that is admirable, but because those legislative processes were completed before we decided or realized that we need to follow a developmental agenda, we have legal clashes looming. Aquaculture development is being hampered not as much by our coastline as by our environmental legislation, slowing down the process. If you ask DEA and if you ask DAF, in whose hands are the latest last bits of the puzzle about where people can farm what, it's in the hands of DEA, not DAF. Because our environmental laws are so strong, it is leaving no space for aquaculture, or very little space for aquaculture at the moment. When we deal with Benguela current species, it gives us a set of preconditions on species exploitation that is extremely rigorous, that gives us very little wiggle room in terms of solving the small-scale fishery problem. When we look at mining, somehow, very unfortunately, most of our coal sits on top of sensitive grasslands, sensitive watersheds, and sensitive catchments. Now, for every coal mine we refuse, we have an energy crisis. For every coal mine we allow, we have an environmental loss. There's no two ways about it. We don't have wasteland with coal. We've got sensitive environmental areas with coal. It's the same with our natural gas. It sits on top of very sensitive groundwater supplies. In South Africa, 1 in 5 towns are dependent on groundwater, so we cannot discount the damage it can do to our rural communities if we find a way to extract gas that happens to impact on our water supply. And finally, also, the water theme that we have lost, unfortunately, but I think we can sneak it into environmental processes. at the point in time, South Africa has got all of its water resources allocated somewhere: urban, conservation, industry, or farming. Every sector that grows from this point forward grows at somebody else's expense or at somebody else's conservation capacity. But we have no spare or surplus water. So whenever we look at a proposal, I would suggest, if I may, that we ask that proposer what the water cost is. If it's irrigation, it's coming from somewhere. If it's mining, it's coming from somewhere. And that, I think, for me, is it the last one? Yes, I was right. It's my research introduction. I'm sorry it was so fast. Sorry, Chair. But
thank you very much. Can we put our hands together for the three presenters? Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over to Honorable Prince to chair the session as we continue with the inputs, questions, where there are areas that you want to clarify. I've got other equipment now that need me immediately to see another committee. So, Honorable Prince, can you...
Is there any questions or comments or inputs? I think it was a very informative session, although I don't want to say what I want to say. A lot came out, but we as politicians must look at what we are going to do, because I'm not disagreeing with you, it was a very good piece of information, I mean, a lot of information, and it's for us to do our oversight work. But to say that we cannot bring small-scale fishes in, I'm going to fight with you, because we have to do, to bring those people in. Those people is living there for ages, being part of the coast, and not having any, getting anything out of it. So we must bring, we must look at ways and means how to bring those people. If we need to take some of those people out, it means that we have to look at the act of new policies. We are going to do it, but those people is going to be in. Thank you. Over to the members for any questions or comments, members.
Thank you. I see that the problem is to say something. Fortunately, I missed out on the first report by the squad. But I was very impressed with the last two. So much that I wanted to check if there is a possibility of combining the two. For instance, yours talks about, like I said, that it talks about the policy context and the key priorities. And I was wondering whether it could not be combined with the COBAS on each of those key priorities. This is a status quo. So I was very, very impressed. But what I also wanted to check with regard to in one of the slides, you talk about the monitoring and evaluation mechanism framework. I'm new, but I wanted to check if the frequency of oversight of departments, for example, departments would have their
annual performance plans, annual operational plans. They would also have quarterly reports, as well as program for the performance program for the next quarter. We have a role as a committee with regard to, one, getting the quarterly reports, two, also getting a report on what are the plans for the next quarter. I wanted clarity on that. Otherwise, I was very impressed. I wish we could have started with this. I understand the reasons why we could not. We had to rush the budget forms, but it would have given us clarity as to how we then deal with the forms, budget forms, and also presentation of strategy plans and the annual performance plans by the department. Starting with this one, we would have done a proper job in terms of that. But also, just a general point that for us to be effective in the oversight, isn't there a way of separating the departments? You have one department that will go. I was really not, I think one Friday we had a committee meeting where we had two departments. One was too busy with one, then the other one came in. We only had one round of questions on the DAF. It was rural development. But we could not follow up questions because already DAF was ready and waiting to do their own presentation. Thank you very much, sir.
Member
Thank you, Chairperson. One is impressed with the presentation. First of all, let me make an apology for coming late. My second apology would be you can see that I'm wearing tickets. It's not that I want to wear tickets, but I fractured my foot. So I have to wait these days till the middle of September. So my apology on that one. It's a pretty Chairperson that the water is out of the sea. It's a real pity. If you remember very well, in the sauna addressed by the state president, he mentioned the Mzimvubu water project, which affects local communities. And it was also mentioned in the last term as well. And I don't know how can we tell that in, but it's very important to assess the rural communities. If you can tell that in, it's a very, very important. We lose a lot of water in that area, whose people are suffering. Then, as far as your presentation on the extension of the concerned, I've been serving on the Agriculture Committee last term, the National Assembly. You are quite right. There's a major problem with the extension offices. A major, major problem. In fact, you're also right that we throwing money down the drain because there's nobody to assist those small businesses. I'm not sure whether ARC will want to assist. I think we requested last time, but it didn't have a feedback on it. But it's something that needs to be addressed, that we need to take up with the department because there are millions of rents that are going down the drain and there is no support system for those people there. One is not where it is made deliberately, or why is that? Are we setting up these people for failure or not? I got a question mark on that because it's been happening for a long time. Are we setting them up for failure? What is happening? So, yes, I agree with you on that one. We need to take those up with the department. As far as CASP is concerned, again, you are right there. A lot of money that goes into CASP. Some of those projects are not viable. When you go there, you don't even see some of those projects. That's the truth of the matter. When you go to oversight, they do not exist on the ground. So I don't know what can we do about this here, really, but we need to do something. Then as far as the restitution is concerned, again, I write here, a case study on Bukhai is the claimant of Ibarin Umtata. That claim, it's about 20 years back. The infrastructure has totally collapsed in that area. It's totally collapsed. But that claim is still not finalized up to today. It's not finalized. And again, you are right. Not only the chiefs, also the communities. You'll find that there are a lot of different communities who are involved in the same thing. And the department does not seem to come up with a solution to that. And then that delays the claim as well, some things as well. Many, many claims. Also the support mechanism. You cannot just give people a sum. Actually, we went to Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and all those areas where you get the increments are sold and all that because there is no support structure. And we need to, it's a waste of money when you don't have, you're setting them up for failure. Then the small scale fisheries, honorable chairperson. It's not only within the small scale service. It's within all the departments. Go to public, also go in. There's a resistance in getting these small people within the mothers. The resistance is there. And we need to break that resistance. I don't know how we're going to do it, but that resistance is causing us all the problems. All wasteful expressions. So we need to come up with a mechanism. How do we break this resistance? Whether it's a radical change or whichever, but we need to break that. It's not only in the it's within all the departments. You go to a construction, you go everywhere. There is that resistance. We don't want you in here. Honorable Kai, if you remember, we're in Eastern Cape. Most of the small contracts are in grade one. They'll never move from there because it is that resistance. The same applies to the small scale fisheries, the small farmers. That resistance is there. So we need to come up with a mechanism of breaking that. But also with the scale fisheries, honorable chairperson, we seem to be confining it in the west coast. But you got the coastal area within the wild coast. There's not much being said. There are fishermen who used to live. There is not much that is being done in those areas. That is an area that we need to look at. What is happening? Why are we not talking about these people here? Because they live in that coast. They used to live out of the... I hope I'm not delaying you, Chira Suna. Okay, let me leave for now. Thank you.
Honorable Member Chai, please.
Thank you, Chair.
Member Matthias first and then Member Singh. Sorry.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just have a clarification question here about the land claims. Who will work with land claims? Will the government appoint people to work with the land claims or will the municipalities as usual run the land claims? My second one is, can I please get a document of the INDP? Because I don't have the NDP. Because I'm still doing these folios. So I'm asking a copy of the document of the NDP. Thank you.
Honorable Member Singh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too want to lend my voice to the presentation that was interesting
and the information that was invaluable for the new members that have come on, like myself as well. But I think that the time span that you've given for this kind of presentation is too short. This requires at least a day workshop so that we can interrogate each of the presentations properly and understand it. I think that my concern is that we are rushing this. This is really a workshop kind of presentation. But the important thing is that I'm touching on is the last issue that was raised regarding the presentation by the research and rhino poaching, and that is a huge problem. And what are we doing in regards to officials that are involved from the department who are colluding with the poachers, because the poachers are generally people outside and there are people inside who are colluding, so the officials and the communities are helping the poachers. So the other very important problem is that the justice system that is in touch on, but the justice system is not really equipped to handle these poachers because they have much, much more money than our budget. And we find ourselves in a rural area, in a rural court. The prosecutors are not equipped to handle this kind of. And that's when they get away. Now, you know this for a fact that if you've got money, you could employ the best advocates, a lawyer, team of lawyers to represent you. So we need to start looking at a court that can handle poaching not only rhinos but whatever, so that the prosecutors are equipped to handle this and the magistrates. Yeah. We need to also revive the debate on the stockpile of rhino horns. There's big stockpiles throughout the country of rhino horns. What do we do with stockpiles? I know there's lobbying now for that to be put on open market, but we need to also debate that and see what are the merits. Chair, I think that, as I said, this would have been a good day if we had the whole day to have this as a workshop presentation. Thank you. Okay.
Continue. Mine was the chair while he's still showing himself. Mine was the follow-up on the details of the process.
Can we just say some order here? I think Honorable Hai, Honorable Matangu was first before you. Thank you. Over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I think mine is to thank the presenters, because this has provided me, at least at a personal level, with so much clarity on how these things work. I mean, the linking of the constitution to the various plans like the NDP and how these things can be followed up to just ensure that Osage is meaningful and effective. But also, it was very interesting to because these are the things that have been happening in my mind as I have been listening to the presentations by the various departments, that when government embarked on this developmental way of doing work, it then sounds like from the presentations that the principles of development did not come with the implementation, like we were talking about the issue of impacts because if you, the minute you start being developmental, you need to not only just concentrate on how much money you spend, but on how much impact the what you have implemented has had on the beneficiaries or on the communities who receive the implementation of programs. And and also just to say that the and it's not personal or anything, it's the appreciation that of the fact that we do need this workshop, or as the first presenter talked about, second presenter rather, talked about the strategic planning, because this has helped for one to focus on specific themes and outcomes, you know, the outcomes approach and things like that. So it's really just an appreciation of the presentation and how it has equipped one even more in terms of one's contribution in the community as well. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Member, hi.
No, thanks again, Sebastian. I was aligning myself with the proposal of Honourable Singh that there could be a danger, once we receive the report, there could be a danger of engaging the report as if we are talking to the department and that they must answer on the issues that have been raised. So I would rather suggest that we have the strategic workshop that was referred to. Though I don't know what would be the issues that would go into the strategic workshop, but I would suggest that these reports must also go to the strategic report, including the strategic and the annual performance plan, so that when we look at the legacy report, we also look at whether the strategic plans and the annual performance plan are taking into account what is in the legacy report. So I wanted to suggest that as a follow-up question. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Fai. A member of Bashkashni?
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry about that.
To forgive me completely. That I will allow it. I also just want to say thank you very much for the very clear and good presentation. And I agree with all the rest of the members. I think that this is a clear picture on the burning issues, but also on the way forward for the committee, seeing that a lot of us are new members. I just want to know, and if there's no answer now, I think I would like us to put that on the agenda for future. And this is when you presented the research, it was just interesting for me to know, is there an interdepartmental work stream or committee or whatever you can call it between these various departments on these issues? Because if there's not something like that, I think that would be a task that this committee could take at hand to promote that, so that we within these departments can address some of these transversal issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think if we had this presentation before, we would be able to ask a lot of questions to the department. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to give an opportunity for Kobus to respond.
Hello. Thank you, sir, Chairperson. You said that the stock is declining, lobster, blah, 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 blah. Now, your breeding projects, does your breeding projects, how are they balanced with the declining stock? And if they are balancing, is the small guy involved in the breeding? That's just a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think if there is no any questions, I'm going to give over for response. Eh?
Okay. There's quite a few questions, but I think Honourable Kai has already mentioned that we didn't present on for the department. We just presented the information within the sector. So I'm just going to group the questions. Honorable Kai specifically made mention, and he reiterated again the importance of a workshop. I think within our committee program, we have it scheduled to discuss induction and strategic planning. Is it next week's meeting, Aska? I think it's in one of the meetings we have, like, we've got it scheduled on how we as a committee is going to look at taking, looking at having induction and looking at strategic planning. But the NGOP is busy with their strategic planning workshop as well in the next week or so. So after that, each committee will have their own strategic planning session. The important thing with monitoring and evaluation is that currently within the section, the committee section, we are developing monitoring and evaluation framework. So that's on the cards, and we're doing it together with the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation in the Presidency. That project is, we're still in implementation, we're still designing it. So there's terms of reference that are out, and we only will be doing some kind of training in September, and following that we'll be running it in each of the committees. But it's a very valid point. I do want to clarify, however, that the way the select committees and the portfolio committees, we work differently. Because we have a clustering of departments, we cannot actually schedule the time to go and look at all the quarterly reporting that they do in the NA, where the National Treasury sends out those Section 32 reports. So it's there, we can avail them, so we can ask more informed questions, but we usually try and look at where the expenditure, what the expenditure patterns are, and where there's going to be problems. The reason why we had two departments on a day is because you have four departments, and in the PV they just have one. So they have a lot more time to actually look at specific issues to that detail. If you look at our my presentation purposes, we looked at high-level policy issues, so government programs that are being run that are national policy but implemented in provinces. So that's the approach that we look at within the NCP. The members representing are here in this committee representing the province and their provincial issues. So they will bring what their constituencies say, and they'll bring that, and that's the kind of robust discussions we'll have. And that's what we'll actually take into our strategic planning, into our induction, because those are things that members from their provinces will bring, and we'll have a look at that. Mr. Bubu, there is a SIP, it's a strategic infrastructure project, so we can try and see how we link it or ask questions on that, but that's going to be a bit tricky because it's water. But if we link it with agriculture, I know it's mentioned in the NDP, so if we can make those linkages, we can probably push it through. The other big thing I wanted to say, the NDP you can get on stores, but I can also have a look. The committee assistant will send one to your pigeonhole. But stored is in the basement. So if you go there, you'll get like all the documents. You'll find annual reports, strategic plans, lots of important government documents that are tabled at Parliament. You'll get at stores. So stores is like the key place to be if you're wanting any kind of documentation. The other important thing I wanted to say is that if you look at the legacy report that ASCA presented, at the end of it, there's an annexure, and that's kind of like the type of strategic plan that we do. So the strategic plan is very simple. It's high level. It looks at legislation, oversight, public participation, and key projects and policy. And then what I've done is I've divided it into provinces. So that's where members can actually provide their specific projects that they'd like to, and we look at that when we're looking at drawing up our program for the committee and looking at our oversight visits, for example. So if you look at that annexure, you'll see that's the kind of thing that we'd be looking when we're doing our strategic planning. I think that was it.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, can we, having agreed that there was a proposal that we park our questions there's going to be, our question is going to find an expression in the strategic workshop that we'll be giving. Let's say they are loaded, captured, because if you also look through the time constraints, but we should also be rushing to another meeting. Can we agree that indeed maybe allow now to take us through the ATC very quickly, and then from there we adopt our routine please. Can we then any appeal that I'm making to honorable members? Thank you.
Thank you, members. On the 19th of June, there was an ATC referral. There's a document that was circulated to members. This is an invitation for the select committee. All members have it. On the second page, the 19th of June, a referral was made to the select committee on land and mineral resources from the Minister of Finance. Invitation for the committee to nominate candidates to serve on the land bank board in terms of the Land and Agriculture Development Act. I've put a memo in the front. I'm introducing the document now. What is required is members the committee is invited to make nominations, so members could find suitable candidates in their constituencies, whatever, that fit the criteria. The act is attached. All the acts and everything is attached to the document. If members find suitable candidates, two things is required: a detailed CV of the person and a letter from the nominee accepting nomination. Once all these nominations have been received, the committee will then sit during one of its upcoming meetings to go through the CVs. We will adopt and accept the nominations and then forward these nominations to the Office of the Minister for referral to the board. As far as that is concerned, item number 3, that is all. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members. Can we then look at our minutes and adopt our minutes and then attend the committee business? Honorable Pakis?
I move, sir.
Okay. Sir. Thank you very much. The business of the select committee is now adjourned. Thank you very much, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.